Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist, here with you today to share the rest of the conversation that I had with my friends Tanya and Andrew about Andrew's perspective on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He refers to himself as an ex-Mormon and speaks of his awakening from the so-called Mormon cult. I suggest if you have not listened to part one of this interview that you do go back and listen to podcast 5 before you listen to this one, podcast 6. You might be just a little bit lost otherwise. At the end of the previous podcast, we had started to talk about the beginnings of the Mormon Church and the origin of the Book of Mormon. And so that's what we'll do. We'll pick up where we left off. We'll move from a discussion of the history of the Book of Mormon to talking about the activities of the present-day Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and their young missionaries. And then we'll talk about how a potential president, Mitt Romney, might be influenced by his Mormon faith. And we'll go on, of course, to talk about ex-Mormons and their support networks.
There was a not-famous author that lived a little before Joseph Smith's time. His name was Solomon Spaulding. And he wrote a novel called Manuscript Lost. It was basically this fictional story of the ancient Hebrews moving to America. And the original novel is truly lost. But ex-Mormon scholars believe that this is a big part of where the Book of Mormon came from.
That he copied it.
Got a copy of it and turned it into this, what is now canon scripture for the Mormons.
Well, sure, we again can say the same thing about the oral mythology that precedes the Old and the New
Testament.
Absolutely. It's just a commonality that all of these faiths share.
Absolutely. And, you know, certainly the Book of Mormon and then the ensuing endowment ceremonies and numerous other parts of the doctrine stole heavily from the Masonic and Masonic belief. You know, a lot of the endowment ceremony is almost identical to their
rituals.
Yeah,
their ordinances.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that a better word? Well, and interestingly, when Mormonism was first coming of age and was first being born, there was a strong anti-Mason sentiment among the population. You know, the founding fathers were all Masons. What are they up to? Who knows
right.
what they're doing? We can't trust them. So the Book of Mormon actually has a lot of anti-Masonic tones and themes in there. And it's ironic that later on when Joseph Smith himself becomes a Mason, and then says, well, the Masons almost had it right, and I had a visit from God, and here's how it really is supposed to go.
Because the similarities are truly remarkable between Masonic ritual and the Mormon endowment ceremony. Seriously,
yeah.
In the outfits they wear, the symbology, the plum, the square, it's almost identical. I mean,
sure. Well, again, as an anthropologist, I'm a big fan of ritual and ritual symbolism, and I know that these symbols get shared and diffused from one culture to the next.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually makes sense to me. The thing that I have trouble understanding, once again, is how 19th century moderns were able to sort of just suspend their disbelief and believe everything that this known and convicted con artist said to them that he pulled out of his hat.
Yes.
Literally.
Well, he put on a hell of a show. I mean, he was not the only one either. There were, at that time, there were a number of other very small Christian sects.
As I said, the Shakers came
there
about.
There were the Shakers, there were the Campbellites. But there was a lot of this kind of thing going around at that time. And also at the time, in the 1820s, 1830s, there was a depression.
Isn't this the Romantic? We're talking about the Romantic period, aren't we?
Yes. Yes, we would be.
Right.
And
so there's this return to nature and spirit,
yes.
spirituality, just in general in Western
yes.
culture.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually a great connection to make. And also, America was a land of great promise.
Right.
You could start your own religious society.
The West was still largely undiscovered and unconquered. I mean, there was still a lot of opportunity. and a lot of room to do whatever you wanted to do.
If you wanted to start a religious commune, you
manifest
could.
Destiny
you still
at its greatest.
And a lot of people try. I think what's maybe this is what makes Mormonism unique is that they're the one group from that whole period, that area in that time that survived. We're talking about them today because they're still around and they got a little bigger.
I think Mormonism is one thing. You know, I was racking my brain the other day to come up with something that's just completely uniquely American, and that's it.
And they pride themselves on that.
Yeah, it is.
On the fact that they're an American religion.
They are, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, after the Book of Mormon was written and the church was founded, they traveled all over, you know, settled in several different places and pretty much got run out of every single place they stopped in until they reached Nauvoo, which was a self-made town. And that was really a Joseph Smith's last stand. But when he was there, he amassed an army. He, you know, started his campaign for president of the United States. He really was probably at his strongest at that point and most destructive at that point. Here's where we saw the birth of the Danites, the sort of Mormon Mossad. It was a very provocative time for Mormonism. Of course, the famous introduction of polygamy came at the same time.
It appears that Joseph Smith was a practicing polygamist long before Nauvoo. But it was in Nauvoo when they came out of the closet, as it were, with their practice.
And what was the rationale for polygamy?
Joseph Smith received a visitation by an angel holding a flaming sword, saying, God commands this, you will take multiple wives, or he would be smitten, he'd be struck down and killed. So he was forced by God, coerced really, to take
he didn't want it.
Multiple wives.
He resisted.
No,
many
no,
of
please.
Them were under the age of 18. In fact, his youngest wife was 14.
14 years old.
Well, again, that doesn't shock me because I know that in traditional societies, that is the age of marriage. And back in America in the 1800s, girls got married at 16. 15,
no, but
16.
It wasn't common. It wasn't the common practice. And I think that's a common myth, is that the idea, and Mormons use that quite a bit. Say, oh, well, you know, back in the day, of course, you know, children, you know, girls married when they were 14, 15 years old all the time. It wasn't common practice. Girls generally were around 17, 18 to almost 20 years of age before they were married.
Well, again, just, you know, from my experience in anthropology, I know that traditional societies will usually marry the women off just as soon as they start to menstruate. And once again, in traditional societies, the age of onset of menstruation is somewhere around 15, 16, thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
That age has gotten much lower in modern America, but 100 years ago, somewhere between 15 and 17, and that
so
is
it could have been possible.
Got married, yeah.
That actually ended up being the downfall of Joseph Smith, was the whole polygamy issue. There was a lot going
well,
on.
Well, numerous
at that
things.
Time. There was a lot of contributing factors.
Yeah, they moved
factors,
from place to place to place, as I said, you know. And every single place that they went to, they would move into a town, open their own businesses, buy up all the property that they could, and refuse to do business with people that wouldn't join the church.
Right.
And so, of course, the people who had been living in the town were angry. You know, they didn't like the Mormons at all. There was a tremendous amount of animosity. Now, this is something that the Mormons now refer to as their persecution. They understand how the Jews feel. They understand how people feel who've been persecuted for their religious beliefs because, you know, they've been through it themselves. But can we really call that persecution when you make that happen? When you, through your own inclusive cult-like nature of wanting to force people to join your religion or not do business with them, not sell them what they need to survive.
I have to go back and say, well, you know, the Orthodox Judaism is the same.
Mm.
Yes.
And
I agree, but I also consider them a cult.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe according to that definition of cult, every religion is a cult up until the modern era.
Entirely possible.
It's entirely possible. Yeah.
And there's many modern religions that have cult aspects to
absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
You know, that you could be a any number of Christian religions and end up becoming a cult.
Les, you earlier referenced the film, the documentary, the brilliant documentary, Jesus Camp, and the extreme manipulation and control going on in that on behalf of the evangelical Christians. you know, telling them to burn their Harry Potter books, right. You know, extreme mind control, a lot of behavioral control there as well.
Sure. I do think it's common to any kind of Orthodox faith, all of these things. I mean, nothing so far that you've told me about sounds to me very shockingly different from any of the other major faiths.
I don't think it is.
So what then explains the unique distaste for the Mormon faith?
I do think that the Mormons have gone to a great length to set themselves apart from everyone else. I do think that their doctrine leads them to believe that they are the chosen people, that they're better than...
Now you sound like you're talking about the Jews again.
But I'm not. And I don't think that the Jews speak up to legislate how America governs its society.
Well, I think there are a lot of Americans who think the Jews run American government.
Yeah, but I think that's a lot of conspiracy. I don't think that that's true. I don't think there are enough of us around.
Yeah,
you know,
another podcast, Tanya.
Another time.
Talk about the conspiracy of the Jews.
That's a good point,
you, me, and Hutton Gibson.
What is it? I agree with you. I do think that Mormons do have this arrogance, this way about them, where they really feel like they're in a position to legislate morals, moral codes among the rest of the population. Like, it's their God-given right to say who you can and can't marry, for example, or what should or shouldn't be taxed, that sort of thing. And I think that's where a lot of people get upset. And they're very evangelical. Mormons have an active missionary force. When I was a missionary, we had, I think it was about 45,000 missionaries worldwide, full-time
wow.
missionaries. You know, 45,000 kids out there pushing Mormonism on the rest of the world.
Wow.
I do know that the evangelical faith, especially the Southern Baptists, really opposed to that sort of intrusiveness of the Mormons. You know, they're campaigning in the neighborhood. They're promising all of this, you know, all of this stuff, because Mormons, they're taught to sell their religion on everybody, and everybody will eventually reach that conclusion that
right.
Mormonism is the way to go.
And I think the fact that they don't drink alcohol, that they don't drink coffee, that they do have this modest clothing, you know, that they really do separate themselves from
right.
mainstream American society, you know.
It sounds so much to me like the historical explanation for the hatred of the Jews.
Oh, you know, I would say I can see where you're coming from. I think it's a little bit of a leap. But I do, I see where the similarities exist. But once again, I think that Mormons would love to have you believe that they're this benign Christian sect. But when we start to look at things like Proposition 8, when we start to look at things like the super PAC behind the current presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, we're looking at a much more insidious and widespread sort of indoctrination and you know, pushing their religion on everyone else. And I don't see that as something that the Jews have historically done.
Right.
I think historically Jews have wanted to be left alone
right.
to practice their beliefs and are pretty much, you know, believe in charity and healing the world and tolerance of other people.
Well, Judaism is traditionally not a religion of conversion,
mm-hmm.
Unlike Christianity and Islam.
Absolutely.
So that sort of stands in its own place. I mean, the Jews believe you have to be born a Jew to be a Jew. You can convert, but it's not easy and it's not encouraged. So, Andrew, can you talk to us, since we brought up the current presidential candidate,
mm-hmm.
Mitt Romney, and I'm hoping that my podcast listeners are one of the things they might be interested in is how might his Mormonism impact a potential Romney presidency? What are the things that you think we should know about Mitt Romney as a Mormon before we go to the polls on Election Day?
Well, I think the American public has already seen a lot of the characteristics that a Mormon candidate would have in Mitt Romney. He is very arrogant, the way that Mormons are arrogant, and believes that he's absolutely right and everybody else is absolutely wrong. That's an extremely Mormon trait. I cannot tell you how many Mormons I've met and known through my life that have that same way about them. I do know that the Mormon faith would definitely drive his policies when it comes to the Defense of Marriage Act or the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I could totally see that going the other way. I mean, why not? It's his God-given right. In fact, it should be that way, or else God will punish the United States.
And I mean, that's another important distinction in the endowment ceremony that Mormons have to go through in order to enter the temple. If I'm not mistaken, and you certainly correct me if I am, they do have to take a vow saying that they will hold God's law above the law of man in all situations.
Yes, that you will follow the prophet above all else. I'm sure that they said the same thing with John Kennedy, you know,
right.
whether or not we would be following the Pope's orders or whether it would be
exactly.
John's orders. And I could see that happening with Mitt Romney. Although, I don't know whether Thomas Monson is really that with it to really want
to current prophet of the Mormon Church.
Command the American government. I don't really see it that way. Mormons are, in general, they're very, very conservative. And what all that means, especially in terms of driving your moral policies or personal freedoms, and very laissez-faire with business. One thing that I wish people looked harder at was the idea of tax exemptions for church donations. Because the Mormon Church is not a charitable donation, and yet the donations you make,
the tithing,
are tax deductible. And Mitt Romney donated $4 million last year to the Mormon Church.
Why do you say it's not charitable?
Well, because the Mormon Church is, first of all, we don't exactly know what's going on with the Mormon Church's finances. That's the Holy Grail.
They're not open to the public.
Yeah, they're not open. So nobody really knows. Except for the Mormon church branches that are in the United Kingdom or New Zealand, where they have to disclose
because of their
governmental laws. But yet we see, like Bill Maher so famously put it, you know, Mormons have castles. You know, true charities don't have castles. We shouldn't have these multi-million-dollar buildings and structures going up, or in the case of the City Mall project in downtown Salt Lake, you know, a $3 billion construction project going on for a tax-exempt church. I mean, really, tax exemptions or subsidy. I mean, the Mormon Church, if you think about it, is getting all of this revenue that would otherwise be taxed. So in some ways, that could be considered a subsidy by the government. So what's so important about what they're doing that would require that the government, you know, support them in that way? Are they really giving all of their money to the poor? I mean, where did that $3 billion that they spent on the City Creek Mall project, couldn't that have been better spent on actual charity work, your wells in Africa or something of that nature? They do have highly publicized charity giving events, and usually around the time of national disasters when the media turn out is at its peak, and the Mormons will show up and give a bunch of truckloads of stuff. But that's a mere fraction of their income. I'm not necessarily saying that churches should be taxed or church donations should be taxed, but at least they should be made public.
Right.
If we could just see where all this money is actually going,
right.
There needs to be more transparency with that sort of thing.
And I have to disagree. I think that when you cross the line where what you're using the church money for goes to having your local bishops and, well, the Mormons don't have clergy, but so, you know, whoever is speaking, encouraging people to vote on any ticket, on any specific proposition or anything, you no longer get that right. You don't,
right.
You not, now
right.
You've entered the political arena and you should be treated
that.
As such. There are laws
right.
against that. Why are they still tax exempt? Why? And, you know, the Mormon Church being tax exempt is, if I'm mistaken, a fairly recent thing. I don't think they were always such.
The policies changed, I'm trying to think, when David O. McKay was prophet, around 1950-something. I think that
right.
they, that time had the same tax status that the KKK had.
Right, and or like the Church of Scientology, which famously got tax-exempt during the Clinton era. I don't think it's acceptable. I think that we're making a gross mistake not opening those books, not forcing them open and examining that. I'm deeply, deeply disappointed in the IRS alone for not saying, you know, not calling them to task on this.
Well, a lot
of money that's not being taxed for them to be legislating anything.
You talk about too big to fail. I mean, they're too big to push around. You know, the Mormons have got a big lobby now. They got a lot of money, a lot of resources. How
a
they
lot,
got a candidate?
All that tithing.
Is there anything in particular that we have to fear from a Mitt Romney presidency because he is a Mormon?
Back to the business end of things, absolutely. The Mormons believe in a doctrine called bleeding the beast, where it is completely acceptable to strip resources and money from anyone that's not righteous, and which is what they define as, you know, Mormon. And it's how they rationalize the Mountain Meadows massacre, among other things that they've done, moving into places and taking over. To take money and resources from the non-righteous is adding money and resources to the righteous and to the kingdom of God.
So it's okay to steal from non-Mormons.
Yes.
It's okay to
lie to non-Mormons.
Absolutely.
So can you tell us a little bit about your awakening from your Mormon reverie?
Sure. My awakening from Mormonism was a long process, and it came in stages. And I suspect that is true with a lot of people coming out of the cult. I initially had questions about creationism versus the Big Bang theory or cosmology, and, you know, a scientific approach to understanding how the universe came to be. So I began to read a lot of books that were written for lay people, like Brief History of Time or Carl Sagan's Cosmos, and to try and understand what the science argument was behind the Big Bang theory. And I came to the conclusion that to deny the existence of the evidence, to look at all that evidence that they have and say it doesn't matter or it doesn't exist or they've got it wrong, was foolish. Now, Mormonism has traditionally long held the steady state theory of cosmology, that the universe always was, it never was created, it's just always existed, the way God has always existed. He's been there forever. There's never been a beginning and there will be no end. It's just one continuous line. So that's a direct conflict with the Big Bang theory. And that was the original thing that got me started. Mormons also believe that in other planets and people on other planets, which I actually at the time thought that was rather progressive and forward-thinking. Of course there's other planets. I mean, look how many planets there are. The science has shown that there are, in fact, bazillions of extrasolar planets right. that exist. And everywhere we point telescopes to look for this very thing, we see more evidence of other extrasolar planets. Mormons do believe that there are sentient beings that are human that live on all those planets. And in Mormon scripture, Moses was, this is in the Pearl of Great Price, Moses was given a vision by God that he was able to see all of the people that God has created on all of the planets. And he made a statement that if you were to take all the grains of sand on the beach, on all the beaches of the earth, or a million earths, you would not come close to the number of people that are on all of these other planets. And there was one savior, sounds kind of Lord of the Rings, you know, one ring to rule them by, one savior that died and was resurrected for all of these people on other planets. And that got me thinking, well, what would it be like to be on another planet, believe in a Christ that didn't even come to your world?
Right.
What was that all about? You know, you're going to believe in, I mean, how would that work? So would you want to go visit the earth that Christ died on, to, you know, like some religious pilgrimage or something? I don't know, there's so many crazy thoughts that could come from just that line of thinking. And I realized in my research and looking at the scientific argument that the Mormon argument really was stupid. And I came to the conclusion that the Mormons didn't know what they were talking about when they talked about the nature of God or the creation idea. It was actually a pretty monumental thing. I remember thinking, you know, I had computed out using, trying to remember the name of that famous astronomer, the Kepler, who came up with this formula for what's the probability of habitable planets within our own Milky Way, and then multiply that by the 400 to a billion other galaxies that are out there, and that's the number of habitable planets probably that could exist. And it was actually a very conservative number. And I came to the conclusion that the Christ that saved everybody that came to this earth, the odds of that happening were so infinitesimally small. It would be like buying 40 lottery tickets and winning the lottery every time, times, you know what I mean? It's just like some crazy long shot odds that would just never happen. So I remember I originally would say, well, Mormonism isn't true, but it's like the odds of it being true are so infinitesimally small that maybe it's not.
Interestingly, you know, when I met him several years later, he claimed he did not believe in God, but that if anyone could prove to him that God existed, he would be a Mormon. He would still be a Mormon. He absolutely still believed that Mormonism was the one true church, that belief was and their doctrine was the right thing.
Yeah, I would allow my kids to be baptized Mormon.
In fact, he had his father come special to baptize his son.
I guess I couldn't baptize him because I didn't believe in God, but I still approved of the idea of my kids being baptized as Mormons.
At the age of 9?
Eight
years old. They're 8 years old.
But in subsequent years, after meeting Tanya and really taking a harder look at the Mormon belief system and what all of that entailed, I went through a rather long and a process of trying to de-Mormon myself, essentially.
Wasn't easy.
You know, coming out of a cult that you're born and raised in and being involved with, you know, for 30 years of your life, that's a difficult thing to do. Because from the time you could understand language, you're being told how to feel and what to think about things. And it's such a part of you. And to come out of that and say, well, no, wait a minute, everything I've been told is a lie, that's a tough thing to deal with.
I had a tremendous amount of anger.
And I felt like I was losing a huge part of my soul, my belief system, my value system, and no longer could I just accept someone else's answers for all of these questions, like how do you feel about lying or cheating, or how do you treat other people, how do you feel about homosexuality, for example, or all these other things, that I could no longer accept the Mormon answers because it was all suspect now. You know, it was all corrupted. So
we were very lucky. Very early on in his, struggle, I got online and did a search and found www.xmormon.org, which was amazing. And we found some amazing, supportive, wonderful people who were in any number of stages of leaving the cult, that were able to really support Andrew and myself as someone who's never been Mormon, but certainly, you know, in love with him and watching him go through this extremely difficult time, at times violently angry. I mean, certainly he would never hurt anyone, but violent in himself, you know, just so difficult to rationalize what he had done in the name of this church.
Well, what had you done in the name of the church that you couldn't rationalize?
Well, I certainly didn't kill anybody in the name of my church, thank God. But just the time and energy I wasted on it, and the fact that my ex-wife is still Mormon, and my parents are all Mormon, and they all talk to each other, and nobody has talked to me at all.
But the arrogance and the time wasted in going to another country to essentially brainwash a people that don't need your help, you know, into your cult, you know, I mean, the time and energy that he spent doing that.
So when you say, you know, you're talking about the mission trips, and the mission work that I'm familiar with today are my students who are evangelical Christians who travel, but they don't go just to preach. They go to dig wells. They go to build houses. They're doing good work in addition to the preaching, and the preaching is sort of put out there as well. You know, here's this well we're building, here's this school we're building, and yeah, you know, by the way, we're having a service on Sunday. It's not you have to take one if you're going to take the other.
I know the Mormons would argue that they do have welfare missionaries and a welfare mission as part of the whole missionary program, but it's a much smaller branch of the missionary program. I would say 90% plus of their missionary force is active and just trying to convert people.
You know, when you're in the field, you're converting, you're going door to door proselytizing. That's what you do.
You'll do something nice for somebody if in return they'll get baptized as a Mormon. But I think that's different than just this altruistic thing of, oh, we're just going to dig a well, or yeah. or start a school, and here's our services. I mean, Mormons, I don't know. It's been 20 years or so since I've been on my mission, so maybe things have changed. But when I was out in the mission field in the mid-80s, it was strictly baptized.
I don't think it's changed at all. And we, up until very recently, continued to be visited by Mormon missionaries. And we would invite them in, have cook them dinner, send them home with stacks of leftovers. These kids, these boys, everything's taken away from them when they enter the field. Mm-hmm. They have, if they're abroad, their passport's taken away. They have no money. They have no airline tickets. They have no way of going home. If they're here in the United States, they have a limited budget that they can use, you know, and that's why you see them on bicycles and walking,
right?
You know, because they really don't have anything else. They have no money to spend on anything. They're always grateful for a meal.
They have no money to spend, yet their families are being assessed $500 a month to keep them in the mission field. Yeah. Yet the missionaries in the field stay at members' houses, and they get an allowance of less than half of that.
Because the families pay money to the missionary training center,
right.
and it all, and then, you know, they all pay the same amount of money, and then that money is redistributed according to need. So you may be putting in $500 a month, but your kid who's out there is getting $110 of that.
Yeah, so
I don't think it's
quite possible it's a money-making proposition for the church.
Like everything else.
Well,
money.
I'm not sure if they're what the baptism rates are now. Since the advent of the internet, there's been a serious decline in the growth of the Mormon Church.
Why would you think that is?
Just the access to information, to alternative views.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, Mormons have had a monopoly on their own information
right.
and generating their own histories. Mm-hmm. So really, if you wanted to study Mormon stuff, Mormon history, you generally read from Mormon sources.
Right.
So you got the Mormon proved versions of history.
One or two published books by people who spoke out against the Mormon Church, the most infamous being No Man Knows My History by Fawn Brody. But so were you to go to the public library, which was the way to, you know, gain information about anything back in the day,
mm-hmm.
There were one or two published books that were anti, quote unquote, anti-Mormon.
They're banned as anti-Mormon literature. So why would you? But now the information is so much easier to get to and readily available. It's hard to, I mean, the Mormon Church does tell their members not to stay away from anti-Mormon sites and not talk to apostates like myself. But it's so easy now. You just do a search on Mormonism and any number of sites like exmormon.org or Mormon Think or
Post-Mormon.
Yeah. There's a number of sites that
and not just that, but there's ex and post-Mormon support groups popping up all over the place.
The social
media
has made it
a lot easier.
There's
a lot of support out there now if you're questioning.
Right. So it seems to me what you're saying is one of the things that fed the Mormon Church was ignorance.
Yes.
And that now that we live in this internet age and it's so easy to get information, the church is declining.
Yes.
I wonder if that's true about other religions as well.
Very possible. One in five is now an atheist
or
agnostic.
Or agnostic.
Yeah.
Right.
Self-avowed. People are becoming a lot more comfortable coming out, so to speak, as full-blown atheists, as saying, I don't believe.
Right.
I have, you know, nothing. I have no magical thinking. And that's a very difficult leap to make, even in this day and age.
Well, we still live in a country where the dominant culture expects you to be a person of faith.
Absolutely.
Yeah, to have some kind of belief in some kind of deity. But I do want to thank both of you for this incredible conversation we've had today and look forward to coming back and chatting with you, doing some follow-up another time. I'm sure that our listeners will call in with some comments and questions. Maybe they'd like to challenge some of what you said.
Absolutely.
That'd be great. And so thanks again, Andrew and Tanya, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a great pleasure, and we'll see you again sometime soon.
Definitely.
Thanks.
Well, that's it. That's all I've got for you today. That wraps up our conversation. I look forward to hearing from you. Let me know what you think. I'd be glad to take some questions back to Tanya and Andrew if you have any. If you'd like to challenge anything that was said, if you have a different opinion, I'd love to hear that. You can send me an email at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com, or you can call the voicemail at 206-312-3526. That's 206-312-3526. Check me out on Facebook, where, as I've mentioned before, I still don't have administrator access, but nonetheless can keep track of your comments and of the likes as they come through. I'm also tweeting at Anonymous Anthro. I look forward to chatting with you in about another 10 days or so. Make sure you get out there and vote. However you vote, just vote. Otherwise, whatever happens, it's your fault. Take care.
Am I recording?